On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's ITRC online training, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I am going to cover some introductory material and some information to help you participate during the training class today. This training is based on an ITRC guidance document, the titles listed there on the screen. That's an online guidance document, and this training serves as an introduction to that guidance document. We hope if you haven't already done so that after the training you will take a look at that guidance document, and it will become a tool for you to use as you work on environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. I do want to note today that because of the government shutdown, we do not have technical support for the CLUIN website, so if you are experiencing problems, we'll do our best we can to help you out with those. If you'll let us know through the Q&A pod, that's the best way to communicate with us, and we'll respond as soon as possible, and we appreciate your patience on that. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Our class is scheduled for about 2.25 hours today. We are recording today's event, so we can provide that as an archive for future ITRC learners. The trainers will be in control of their slides today, and we'll move through those as they move through their presentation. However, if you would like to get a copy of the slides, you're welcome to do so. You can access that through the related links where it says CLUIN training page. There's a place there that you can download a copy of the slides. We do want to hear from you, both your questions and your feedback today. You can enter questions at any time during the training session in that Q&A pod. We hope to be able to have some time midway through as well at the end to answer some of your questions verbally. We will also have trainers in the background responding directly to people asking questions in that Q&A pod. At the end of the class, we will encourage all of you to fill out the feedback form. That helps us improve not only this class, but other ITRC courses as well, and provides you an opportunity to get a certificate of participation. More information about ITRC is available on our website, but ITRC is a state-led organization hosted by the Environmental Council of States. We work with federal partners, being Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, along with industry members who participate in ITRC's Industry Affiliates Program. We also work with academia and community stakeholders. All these groups work together through technical teams to develop guidance and training, such as the one you're participating on today. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, please review that ITRC usage policy and credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We do encourage you to check out the variety of ITRC guidance documents and other tools available on the website. We also have a full list of 2019 online and classroom training events. Registration is also open for you to become a part of ITRC by participating on technical teams, so we encourage you to check that out again on the ITRC website. It's now my pleasure to introduce our trainers for today. All of them have been members of ITRC's Geospatial Analysis team. And if you'd like to read more about them, their bios are available at the link on the bottom of the screen. First, we'll be hearing from Dave Becker. He is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Adam Jansen is with Barr Engineering Company. Chris Stubbs with Ramboll. And Mike Kwasinski with the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. So we'll move on to slide number 6. And Dave Becker, I'll turn it over to you. And Dave is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Dave?
Okay. Thank you very much, Mary. It's certainly a pleasure to be able to talk about two of my favorite topics, optimization and geospatial analyses. And looking here at the current slide, I like to call this our milepost or signpost slides because it tells you what all we're going to be discussing today with the seminar, and it highlights where we are in the sequence of topics. And so I get the fun chance to talk about the first couple of items there on the list of topics. So let's jump right in and talk about some, just some fundamental concepts here. First, I would like to just kind of say that I would bet most everybody on the call today has used geospatial analysis, whether they realize it or not, at some point in their career. Geospatial analysis is most commonly encountered in our work through any kind of computer-generated contour maps. And, you know, I've got an example on the right-hand side of the slide. But, you know, so if you've ever used any of these computer-generated contour maps, you've used geospatial method. And most commonly, these kind of maps are of groundwater levels, contours of groundwater levels, contours of contaminant or other parameter concentrations, you know, plume maps, or in the geologic realm, the contours of geologic contacts, the top of bedrock or something like that. And so, you know, that's a very fundamental thing that we use all the time. And so it shouldn't be that scary or unfamiliar. So I do want to emphasize that even though you're going to hear tons of stuff about geospatial methods during the discussion today, really what focus we have for these geospatial methods and analysis is on optimizing what we do on our cleanup projects for our environmental sites. Because, you know, I'm sure everybody on the call knows that their supervisors or, you know, the stakeholders or their clients are asking that more be done with less resources all the time. And so optimization becomes very important in order to fulfill those kind of expectations. And certainly the federal agencies, including my agency, Department of Defense, have really identified optimization as being something that is worth pursuing and has provided, you know, a number of policy documents and guidance documents and even funded tools for conducting optimization at various points in the life cycle of our projects. And initially, though, the focus might have been on sites that were under construction and operation, but more recently, more agencies have really recognized that optimization should be part of every step in the life cycle of a project. And ITRC has been right in there preparing guidance on optimization of these kind of sites. And matter of fact, there was a team that I participated on, the remediation process optimization team, that prepared a very good technical regulatory guidance document and a number of fact sheets that you may find useful. And just to point out here that on this slide and any of the slides in the presentation that are in blue and have that underlined, that means that in the file that you can download, that's an active hyperlink that will take you to the appropriate website to get those resources. And speaking of resources, there are many other tools that are out there. Some of them are on the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable optimization page. There's a link there. EPA's CLUIN website has a very good optimization website or web pages for that as well. And so there's lots of places to go for more general information about optimization. But again, our focus today is on applying geospatial analysis as part of that optimization. So let's go to the next slide here. And I do, you know, this is part of the sales job here. I want to make it clear why this should really matter to you. Certainly, geospatial methods are helpful in optimizing the work we do, and it's always good to start with a definition. And I've got here on this slide a good definition that I like for optimization. That's, you know, basically anything that we do at any step in the process of cleaning up our site to identify and make happen things that improve effectiveness and cost efficiency at that phase, that life cycle phase. And so that's a pretty broad definition, and there's many ways that the geospatial tools can help with that. And I've got here on this slide just one example of how geospatial techniques can really help with optimization, in this case with monitoring at a site. And so we've got a couple of figures here on the right, one that shows kind of a color fill of concentrations based on a monitoring network with all the wells, and then we have another figure that shows the color fill based on data with a reduced number of monitoring points, with the excluded monitoring points shown. And by comparing the two side by side, you realize that we can exclude sampling from those wells and still end up with pretty much the same contour map of concentrations, or, you know, and it could be head or whatever, and still, you know, have good basis for making decisions. And so that's a way to maybe reduce the cost for performing sampling or water level measurements or whatever. Similar kinds of techniques can be done with these geospatial tools and methods. So, you know, this should matter because it helps in several ways on our projects. You know, I just mentioned that it can help us reduce our costs, and the cost savings can come by helping us do a better job planning, say, our efforts either in characterization or in remediation. And there are a number of geospatial methods that can help us optimize that. They can also be something where geospatial methods can help us demonstrate to the regulatory agencies or to the stakeholders that we've actually done the appropriate amount of cleanup to attain our goals. And so that, you know, that's really starting at the beginning and getting to the end of all the life cycle for a project that can really help us there and save us some money. Another way that geospatial methods can help us is in enhancing our ability as professionals to evaluate and interpret the results of our sampling and other monitoring activities. Certainly by good planning, we get better data, so the data hopefully are better quality and better located. But these methods can help us identify both spatial and temporal trends and patterns in the data more readily. This can help us also identify maybe more accurately the amount of material that needs to be remediated, groundwater or soil, for example, or to quantify the uncertainties in those estimates so that we can make better decisions or better informed decisions about things like the amount of contingency funding that we might need to have. Another area where geospatial methods can really help us and does help us is in communication, in providing visualizations for the results that we collect, because a picture really is worth a thousand words. So let's just give an example here of how geospatial tools can help us in the interpretation and evaluation of data. For example, maybe we're interested in trying to understand the origin, the evolution of the contaminant distribution that we see at a site. Geospatial methods can help us with that. And so we have an example figure here where we have, at the top right here, a map that shows zinc concentrations as indicated by the size of a circle. The higher the concentration, the bigger the diameter of the circle, at each sampling point relative to a nearby river. And you'll hear more about this case study a little bit later. But you can see that the circles with the larger diameters tend to be near that river, and then the circles farther away are smaller. And matter of fact, the lower right figure here shows the concentration in a graph as a function of distance from the river. And you can see that the concentrations tend to decrease with distance from the river, suggesting that some river process, possibly periodic flooding on the river and deposition of zinc-contaminated sediments onto the adjoining property, that may be a source. So that just these tools in showing us the spatial relationship can really help us understand and develop our conceptual site model. So let's talk a little bit about the communication aspect. You know, with the increase in computing power that we've had, certainly over my career, we have at our disposal visualization tools that can show two-dimensionally, three-dimensionally, the concentrations or other geologic features or whatever in a way that communicates very readily what's going on at our sites. And I've got an example here. The figure at the bottom of this shows the material that's identified at a site for excavation relative to the topography and some of the site features. And so, again, this would be something very useful at a public meeting to explain to stakeholders what's going to happen and where and how that might affect different things around the site. You know, these same kind of things can help professionals communicate to each other, you know, between those professionals involved in the characterization and those involved in the design and implementation of the remediation itself. Obviously, these kind of things can really be helpful. So, very good applications there. So now let's take a quick break and ask another poll question. And we'd like to know more about how you may apply or use or be familiar with, well, or at least apply geospatial analysis here. So if you could categorize yourself as one of those sort of categories, that'd be ideal. It certainly helps the instructors for the training understand who it is that we have listening to us today. We can modify our lectures just a little bit based on that. If you're participating as a group in a room with a single connection, pick the one that perhaps best represents the folks that are there with you. And so just watching as the results come in here, it seems like we have quite a number of technical practitioners who are familiar with and apply the methods. We have another large group that consider themselves technical reviewers, and between the two of them, it's about 70% of those of you who are on the call, which shows that we have probably a fairly sophisticated audience today. But we still want to kind of cover the basics, and you're going to hear a lot about geospatial methods today just to make sure everybody's familiar with those kind of things. So, okay, we can go ahead and close that poll, and we'll go on to our next slide here. Let me just talk very briefly about the guidance on the application of geospatial methods for optimization of environmental cleanup. This document is, you know, really handy, really useful, really user-friendly. It's a web-based hyperlink-type document that allows you to very rapidly drill down to the information that would help you do what you need to do, answer the questions you have. And I do want to highlight some of the sort of bonus features here that come with the document. We have a number of fact sheets that are available that cover specific topics in more detail, so you can get right to those. There is, so you can see the list of fact sheets here. There are four of them there. We have a summary table about the software that can perform some of these geospatial analysis, kind of identify qualitatively the ease of use and the relative cost for some of these different tools. And there's a lot of different tools that will do some of the things that we talk about. There's also for the project managers in the group, and we did see some of the folks that are on the line today are project managers. There's a toolbox that will take you right to, you know, kind of a one-stop shop for a lot of the tools that are going to be most relevant to you, including quick access to the fact sheets and some of the other tools there. So that's something really nice. There's also a review checklist. A number of people on the poll question indicated that they were a reviewer of these kind of analysis. So there's a review checklist associated with the document that might help you make sure you don't miss something when reviewing something that comes in for you. And then lastly, the document has a number of flowcharts, some of which you'll see during the presentations today, that help the user through the process. So particularly if you're not an experienced pro at this, you can still get started and learn a lot about the application of these kind of methods in the right way. So these flowcharts are really, really handy. So really want you after the training to go try out the online document so you get familiar with all the stuff that it has. So just a little bit more about what we were hoping to accomplish with the document and what we're hoping to accomplish today with the training is that we want folks involved, either, you know, as project managers or, you know, at technical professionals or even stakeholders to be familiar with some of these methods in ways that you are able to identify the applicability of these different methods for different aspects of our cleanup tasks. We also wanted to provide some questions related to optimization that would spur thoughts about ways to optimize what we're doing in each life cycle phase, and then tie those questions to specific geospatial methods to accomplish those optimization type tasks. And so we want the document to help you select the appropriate geospatial methods again. And then we also wanted the document and this training to get you started to understand and then hopefully apply the results of these geospatial methods. So, obviously with a 2-hour-plus training like this, it's very difficult to, make anybody an expert. We want to give you a flavor of the topics and the document and really encourage you to go to the document for more detail because that's where the detail is going to be. Okay, so here we are to another milepost slide, like I say, and I want to talk now just a little bit about, some of the issues surrounding the application of geospatial methods. And then I'm going to turn it over to my fellow instructors to go into more detail on some of the methods. So one key aspect, and this is kind of almost a backbone of the document, is there is an advised workflow for performing geospatial analysis, and it's kind of laid out here on the slide. And of course, the place to start, as is usually the case, is to review our conceptual site model and the project goals, just so that we understand the context of the site and what we're trying to accomplish at the site. So always good to look at the CSM to start, but then for the geospatial analysis, we start by looking at our data, the water levels or the concentrations or whatever that we're looking at. Do some initial exploratory data analysis or statistical analysis on those to get a better understanding of that data set. Next step would be then to choose the appropriate geospatial method to accomplish the goal of our application. What are we trying to do? What question are we trying to answer? What method is going to be best to do that? Then to apply that method, to build a geostatistical model or check the model or whatever. Now, I should point out that there are those flowcharts that I mentioned that will help you through each one of those items on the workflow. And again, that link there to the flowcharts on the slide will take you right to those so you can see them. The last step then is to generate the results, the predictions and evaluation of uncertainty and evaluate that. And again, that's where the review checklist I mentioned before would come in handy. Okay, so here, I know this is tough to read, but I just wanted to kind of illustrate the kind of flowcharts that are in the document. This actually shows that there are some fairly detailed decision trees there to help guide you through that workflow. This is just an example. Okay. So regarding the application of these methods, there are often a number of questions that come up, and they're listed here, some of the more common ones. How much data are required? What are some of the problems that I might run into in dealing with some of the stakeholders and regulatory agencies? How are these methods misapplied? Particularly if you're a reviewer, that might be of interest. And then again, the focus is how can we apply these methods to optimize our work? Excuse me, at these sites. So let's talk about each one of these categories here. So the first is, what are the data requirements for applying these geospatial methods? Well, obviously we're dealing with spatial things, so we need to have spatial data. We need to have data that are collected associated with a specific location in space and time. And so we got to have coordinates for them. Horizontal coordinates, for sure. In some cases, vertical coordinates as well. We obviously need to have the context, like I say, with the conceptual site model, and that includes cleanup goals. But the kind of data that we would have that would be the spatial data would be, the hydrogeologic information, anything from water levels to hydraulic conductivities, moisture content, something about the grain size or organic carbon content at a given location. And then, of course, there's the chemical concentrations, whether it's, natural cations and anions or site contaminants or whatever. Those are the kind of spatial data that we're typically dealing with. Now, the real interest is often how many data do we really need? And that really depends on the geospatial methods. And there's the flow chart here on the left side of this slide is one that's in the document. Again, I refer you to that to be able to read it in more detail. But it actually asks you the questions, you follow it through, and then will help you identify what your data requirements would be for three categories of methods. And we've categorized them somewhat qualitatively as simple methods, more complex methods, so sort of like the middle ground, and then the advanced methods and things like geostatistics, and that would be in that latter category. And the data requirements are going to vary depending on which kind of method you've got there. So let's go on. What about the regulatory barriers and concerns? And, looking at the poll question that was up before the start of the class, it appears that a lot of the folks on the call have not really run into a lot of resistance to the use of these kind of methods, which is excellent. And many state and federal agencies have not only accepted but may encourage the use of some of these methods, and many agencies and states are also very open to optimization ideas as well. But sometimes you do run into some resistance, maybe some unfamiliarity. It varies by the state and the agency, and so obviously you need to verify that before you start applying them too far. One thing that certainly comes up as a result of optimization is that if you are trying to change the direction of a project based on the optimization study, that might involve some administrative requirements and hurdles that might make it time-consuming or even difficult to implement. But in a lot of cases, it's worth it to go through that. The hesitancy or reluctance to accept these geospatial methods is often associated with an unfamiliarity with the methods. And that's exactly what we're trying to address with the document and this training, is to get more people familiar and comfortable with these methods and to see how they can be responsibly used to do good things for the project. So if we could go back to that poll question, see if anybody wants to update their thoughts on the experiences they've had in applying geospatial methods and the resistance there. And you can see that over 90% of the respondents around 90% have not really hit that resistance, which I find very encouraging. But we still have that 10 or so percent of folks who have, and we really want to make that number go down with this. So let's go ahead and close that poll. Appreciate that. So let's talk just a little bit about the common misapplications. And like anything, things can be misapplied. Tools can be misapplied. And I've identified some of the example misapplications there, everything from just not having the right amount of data to extrapolating data beyond the spatial bounds of where you've got samples collected or whatever, ignoring the implications of sensor data or, not considering uncertainty. One of the things that does come up occasionally is that the spatial methods that we deal with, some of them are not very adept at considering the natural heterogeneities and anisotropy in geologic environments. So if you're dealing with groundwater, sometimes the methods can't take into account these kind of features. And the figure here on the right shows a fault that cuts across this area that's got water level maps, water level map on it. And if you use some of the methods, those methods may not know that fault is there and will just treat all the data as being from one particular zone or one particular aquifer without that boundary being considered, and that may result in significant differences in how you would interpret the data than if the method did take that into account. And there are ways that you can account for that, and you'll hear more about that. Again, there are discussions in the guidance document about misapplications, common misapplications, and you'll hear more during the presentation today. Okay. As I mentioned, the one of the key things about the document is to try and focus the application of these methods to optimize our work at each lifecycle stage. And so one of the things that's in the document is a list of questions related to optimization relevant to each lifecycle phase, from release detection, you know, determining if there's a problem or not, all the way to site closure. And there are a lot of different questions. I've put here just, you know, a number of, you know, representative questions for each of those life cycle phases. There are many more that are discussed in the document. And then, as I mentioned, then the document identifies the geospatial methods that will help answer these questions and what tools can be used to implement those methods. So, you know, here just for an example, one of the questions in the site characterization phase is, what is an appropriate sample spacing considering spatial correlation? And you'll hear more about this in the coming parts of the lecture. But, when you're planning your characterization effort, you want to be as cost-effective as possible by choosing a sample spacing over an area or perhaps along, you know, some type of feature like a stream. You want to take into account, just how similar results taken close together are relative to those taken farther apart. You want to be able to space these samples, relatively as far apart as possible while still characterizing the site, not getting a bunch of duplicate information by sampling too close together. And so you can use things like the construction of a variogram to understand the spatial correlation and to pick, based on that, some kind of sample spacing and use that in your sampling planning to reduce your costs and have a strong scientific basis to defend that that decision. So that's just one example of the kind of information that would be in the document. Okay. So where do we go from here? We want to be able to answer those optimization questions, and that means we need to know what geospatial methods are out there and the right ways to use them. And again, you're going to hear more about these different geospatial methods, and we've categorized them again as simple, things like inverse distance weighting, to more complex, to advanced, like geostatistics, and you're going to hear about those, and the software tools that can be used to apply these methods. Okay. So let's do one more poll question here. Based on what I've talked about, with the sales job that I've done here, do you think you've got sites that could benefit from these geospatial analyses? And, you might answer yes, you might answer, no, or you might still need to know more, okay? And let's see here. It looks like as the poll numbers come in that we have quite a few people, somewhere around 75-80% saying yes. Some people don't know yet. And it's kind of nice to see nobody said that we don't need geospatial analysis. So, for those of you who still don't know yet, the 20% or so, you're going to hear a lot more about this, and hopefully you're going to be more comfortable with that, and you're going to see the applicability of this kind of stuff. So let's go ahead and close that poll for right now, if we could. All right. Thank you, Mary. And go now to another milepost slide, and at this point, I'm going to turn this over to a very knowledgeable colleague, Adam Jansen, with Barr Engineering in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
All righty. Thank you, Dave. So our goals for this next fundamental section are to try to give you kind of a high-level overview of how geospatial methods work. So like in 20 minutes, we can't cover everything, but we're going to try to hit some of the most important points, and then there are a lot more details to be found in the guidance document. Tobler's first law of geography here on this first slide sums up the basic premise of geospatial methods pretty well, you know, which is if we go out and we collect samples at, you know, say two locations that are really close together, we would expect those sample results to be pretty similar. But then if we move those 2 points farther and farther apart, we would kind of expect the results to be more and more different. And so that relationship between similarity and proximity is called spatial correlation. And if we have spatial correlation in our data set, which is true for a lot of environmental parameters, we can try to quantify that using geospatial methods. And then once we can quantify it, that helps us to understand more about what might be going on kind of between our data points where we don't actually have any information, and then allow us to try to optimize ask ourselves some optimization questions. So things like, you know, do we not have enough data? And, you know, if we go to add more, where can we add more points for maximum value? Or conversely, do we have maybe too much data? Like some of it is basically redundant, and if like we have to go keep sampling this site over and over again in the future, maybe we can leave out some of these sample points in the future and try to save some money. But the key concept here is the spatial correlation. So we're going to try to illustrate that here on this slide. Our far left image here shows a case of a hypothetical data set, you know, where we've symbolized some parameter using different colors and symbol sizes. On the far left, those colors and symbol sizes appear to be kind of randomly distributed in space. So there isn't really any obvious spatial pattern here, so there is no spatial correlation, and we really can't do anything with this data set using geospatial analysis. However, the other two data sets here would be good candidates for a geospatial analysis. In the middle, we have large-scale systematic variation, which is known as a trend. So we have kind of this like smoothly varying pattern here to the colors. An example of what we could be looking at here are, say, groundwater elevations. So it's easy to imagine drawing a groundwater contour map where your contours kind of line up with the color separations, and you have kind of a one-dimensional flow field to the lower left corner of the figure. On the right, we have a bounded spatially correlated variation, which is known as an autocorrelation. So the variable is kind of correlated with itself in space. And this kind of tends to look like clumps of similar values. So as an example, these could be concentrations of some contaminant in the subsurface, say at a former industrial site. These black bars are on here to indicate the apparent scale of the spatial correlation. That's a really important concept we're going to come back to in a few slides. Now, we should note that the autocorrelation and the trend are not mutually exclusive cases, that in many data sets there's some combination of both, and so to effectively model this, you may need to decompose the data set into the trend and autocorrelation components. So to try to explain a little bit more what we mean by that, imagine that we've collected a very high resolution data set and we're looking at a slice through it. So that's our raw data here on the black line. You see there's a lot of variability in that, but there is kind of this larger scale overarching pattern to it that we've traced with the blue line. So in this case, the blue line would be the trend component, and then the autocorrelation component would be the deviation from that trend. So our geospatial model can include up to three components. So the trend and autocorrelation components we just talked about, and then the third component is an error model to try to account for error in our measurements. And as Dave mentioned in the introduction, in the ITRC guidance document, we have classified geospatial methods into three categories: simple, more complex, and advanced. And those classifications are based on kind of which components of the geospatial model you could model with those particular methods. So any of the methods, the simple, the more complex, or the advanced, could be used to model a trend. But if we want to include an error model in our analysis, we're limited to using the more complex or advanced methods. And what sets the advanced methods apart is that they try to explicitly model this autocorrelation component. So for some examples of like how different methods you may be familiar with fall under this classification scheme, we see the simple methods mainly are just some kind of basic interpolation methods, so things like natural neighbor interpolation, Voronoi diagrams, and so on. The more complex methods are many different types of regressions, so you're kind of trying to get like a best fit surface into your data. And then the advanced methods are similar to regressions, but then they kind of extend that to include this autocorrelation model. So the advanced methods are what you may have heard called the geostatistical methods. And so Krieging is the kind of the base method, and there are a lot of different types of Krieging that have been developed for different applications. So because we have classified geospatial methods kind of based on their capabilities, it follows that, you know, certain methods might be more appropriate for some tasks than others. So for instance, the simple methods are mainly useful for mapping. So say you have a data set of point data and you want to interpolate that into a continuous surface and then show it as like a color map or draw contours from it. So the simple methods would all work very well for doing that. And then evaluate, you know, how good the result is, making sure that it's consistent with your conceptual site model. The simple methods are just fine for interpolation, if that's all they're after. That's all you're after. Those values that you're interpolating, they just give you the value. They can't give you any idea of like a level of uncertainty associated with that value. But you can get that from the more complex or advanced methods. So they're much more helpful for the optimization type questions, where we need to, you know, have an idea of what kind of uncertainty is associated with the values that we're interpolating. One thing we want to caution you about a little bit is that some software packages have some default parameters in them that kind of take the place of the statistical modeling that you need to generate those uncertainty estimates. And so, as an example, it's really easy to go into Surfer with a point data set and then generate a contour map using kriging, which is an advanced method, and then you'll not have to do any kind of click go. You don't have to actually do any statistical modeling. And if all you're after is the contour map, that's fine, but in such a case, don't put any stock into the uncertainty estimates that come out of the algorithm because you haven't gone through the modeling that those are based on. So in a case where you're not, you know, fully using the method, you can be kind of converting the more complex or advanced methods to just simple methods, which for mapping is okay, for optimization, not so much. Kind of sum up where we are so far. We have to have spatial correlation in our data set to be able to use geospatial analysis in the first place. That's the good news. The bad news, something you need to consider is that if you think you need more data in your data set, simply adding more points won't necessarily give you more information because it's also important to realize where the points are located relative to one another. And specifically, if you space data points too close together, you're probably collecting some redundant information that, you know, isn't really adding any value. And so to try to understand how to avoid that, we need to know what this scale of the spatial correlation is. And so to do that, we use something called the variogram. So the variogram is basically, it's a plot of variability on the y-axis as a function of distance between sampling locations on the horizontal axis. If you're using kriging or other advanced methods, the variogram is that explicit autocorrelation model that you need for that. But even if you're not using kriging, the variogram is still useful by itself because we can use it to quantify that length scale of spatial correlation. On this slide here, we have a kind of a classical variogram for conceptual purposes. So variability on the y-axis, point spacing on the x. These individual points on here are what are known as either the experimental or empirical variogram. They're not your actual data points. They're derived from a lot of number crunching of the data set, and the guidance document explains how that's done. Well, once you get to this point where you have these individual points, then you fit this theoretical variogram model to it, which is the solid red line. Thinking back to the Tobler's first law of geography we talked about earlier, you can see this is consistent with that if you start spacing your points farther and farther apart, then variability also starts to increase. But then only up to kind of a certain distance here, at which point the variability levels off. And so the magic distance at which that happens is called the range of the variogram, and then that is the scale of spatial correlation. This value of variability that it levels off at is called the SIL of the variogram. And this theoretically is the variance of your data set. Now, one other feature here is called the nugget, and that's the y-intercept of the variogram model. So that's zero for this particular case. The nugget is where you would include an error model into the variogram, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few slides. One thing to kind of be careful about that I'll mention here when coming up with the variogram, you know, is that you're trying to relate variability to distance between points, but it can also matter like how the points are oriented relative to one another in addition to how far apart they are from each other. So as an example, if you collect, say, concentration data in soil at different depths, you know, you have variability that's related to how deep you are and also to at what XY location you're at. And so those two different sources of variability may need to be separated in the when you're going to generate the variogram. And there's more discussion about this in the guidance document. Let's go back to those three different cases of spatial correlation and show you what a variogram would look like for each one of them. So in the case where we don't have any spatial correlation in our data set, you'll be able to see that in the variogram if you just get a horizontal line. And so this can be one way to identify whether or not you have spatial correlation. The case where we have a trend, we get this unbounded variogram that never reaches a sill. And so as you can see, especially along this axis of the trend, when you're comparing pairs of points to generate the variogram, the farther and farther in part you go along this axis, the more and more different the values keep getting. And so that's why it never levels off, and the variability will just continue to increase the farther your point spacing is. Finally, the autocorrelation case here gives you this kind of conceptual variogram that we looked at on the previous slide, where at distances smaller than the length of these bars, which are the scale of spatial correlation, you see a lot of similarity between the data points. But then once you start to get outside of that, it starts to look a lot more like the random case, and then you get the horizontal line. So at this point, it would be a good idea to take a pop quiz. And I'll show you the same variogram that we showed before, just this time there are numbers on the axes, and we're going to ask you what are the range and the sill of this variogram. So while we're giving people a chance to answer this, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the nugget of the variogram. So the nugget, remember, is the y-intercept of the fitted model. For this particular variogram, the nugget is zero. And so what that is saying is that if you went out and you collected two samples at exactly the same location, you should get exactly the same value. And that may be true in some cases. You know, we can usually measure water levels to pretty high or pretty precise with that. They're very repeatable. But, you know, if we collect duplicate samples at the same monitoring well, often the results will come back from the lab and you'll have different concentrations that were collected at exactly the same well at almost exactly the same time. And so in those cases, we know that there's error in our measurements, and so we can use that information to try to set an appropriate non-zero value for the nugget to try to account for that additional variability due to measurement error. So it looks like the number of answers coming in here is kind of slowing down, so I'm going to go ahead and end the poll here. Far and away, most people answered C, and that's good because that's the right answer. The range of this variogram is 24. And then the sill was 9. So the sill, as we recall theoretically, is the variance of our data set. And then the range is that all-important scale of spatial correlation that has implications for sample spacing. So as an example of how that would work, we'll take a look at one of the case studies that we have in our guidance document. So this is a site where there's sediment contaminated with PCBs. And the authors of this study went out over a 7-year period and collected 749 samples of this sediment, analyze them for PCBs, and then use that information to try to delineate the area of sediment that they would have to remediate that had concentrations above the standard. After they did all that, though, they kind of looked back and said, wow, 749 is a lot of data points. Do we really need that many to get the answer that we got? So they went back and did kind of this retrospective geospatial analysis to see if they could have gotten the same answer with fewer data points. So to kind of summarize what they did here in this table, after the first 2 years of sampling, they had collected 240 samples of sediment. So they generated a variogram using those 240 data points and found that it had a range of about 400 feet. If they had kept that 400-foot number in mind, then when deciding where to put any additional samples, so try not to put any new point within 400 feet of one you already collected, they found they really only needed maybe 24 more points. To get enough data to get basically the same delineation they got with the full 749. And so certainly they could have collected maybe 24 more points in one more year, when in reality they went out over 5 more years and collected another 509 samples, which we can infer a lot of those probably were redundant. So this is a very dramatic and, you know, somewhat hypothetical example, but just shows, you know, some of the power of these methods, helping you guide your sampling approach once you know something about the site, and then trying to make sure that you don't collect more samples than you really need. So on this particular slide, we're going to show 6 different contour maps that were all generated using the same data set, but using different geospatial methods to try to highlight some of the similarities and differences between them. So we'll start off with a couple of what we call the simple methods here, triangulation and natural neighbor. These give pretty similar looking maps. One thing you notice right away is that these methods, by definition, can only interpolate, and so the contours here are limited by the extent of the data. These methods can't extrapolate past those at all. Also a simple method, but which works pretty differently, is called inverse distance to a power, or inverse distance weighting. And so this interpolates values using a weighted sum of nearby data points, and the weights are based on an inverse power function of distance between them. One thing you'll notice in the results here is that this method has a tendency to produce bullseyes in contour maps and bullseyes around particular data points. This may or may not be a problem depending on what it is you're contouring. Now, for concentrations, this could be just fine. I would caution you against using this method for groundwater elevation contour maps because closed contours there have a very specific meaning for sources or sinks of water to the aquifer, and artifacts introduced by this interpolation method, you know, don't have any physical meaning, and you don't want to draw the wrong conclusion from the map. So not to say you shouldn't ever use this method, but just be very careful to evaluate the results against your conceptual site model and make sure they make sense. Moving on to a more complex method, local polynomial regression. This gives a much smoother surface than any of the simple methods, and the reason for that is the regression is not bound to honor all of the data points exactly the way the simple methods are, and so that's why you can get a much smoother surface out of it. So that may be a problem depending on the application. We'll talk about that more in a couple of slides. There are other more complex methods like the radial basis functions that do a much better job of locally matching data points. And then finally, kriging, an advanced method, gives you a pretty similar looking map to that. Kriging is also like inverse distance weighting in that it uses a weighted sum of nearby data points, but it computes the weights very differently than this, and so you largely avoid the bullseyes. So now that we have all six of them here on the screen at once, I mean, don't be alarmed that they're all different, even though they came from the same data set. As I try to explain, these methods are based on different assumptions and algorithms, and so they're not exactly going to produce the same results, even with the same inputs. But an obvious question, of course, is, well, which one should I use for my application? And that will depend on things like how much data you have. You know, you need a lot more data to use the advanced methods than the simple ones, and also just what question you're trying to answer. And so as Dave showed you in the introduction, there are some very comprehensive flowcharts in the guidance document that will help step you through the questions and like things you need to consider to try to decide what would be the best method to use. So as I said, kriging and inverse distance weighting are using a sum of nearby data points. And so in the software, then, you have to define what counts as a nearby data point. And so the parameter that does that is called the search neighborhood. We usually try to set the search neighborhood pretty small to try to maximize some of the variability in the data and not smear things out too much in the interpolation. But especially if your data are not spaced very evenly, it can be very easy to come up with something like this lower left figure where you have really sharp transitions in a color map, or you'd end up have really jagged contours if this were a contour map. So if you see something like this in your results, this is almost always an indication that your search neighborhood is too small. And you can smooth things out considerably and, you know, get rid of some of these discontinuities simply by increasing the size of the search neighborhood radius. So exact interpolation is another way of saying that you honor all of your data points exactly. So everywhere that you have a data point, the method has to return that exact value. By definition, most of the simple methods have to be that way. The more complex methods, not so much, and then kriging can go either way depending on what value you use in the nugget. So we use kriging to generate these two figures here. We use kriging with a zero nugget in the variogram for the upper figure, and so in that case, this is an exact interpolation, so we match all of our data points exactly, versus the lower map was generated using kriging with a non-zero nugget. So we've incorporated that error model into it, and now we get a much smoother map, but one that doesn't match all the data points exactly. So it can be difficult to defend the lower map here when it's very easy for a client or a regulator to zoom in like we're going to do here and see, well, wait a minute, like why does your 170 contour not go through these two 170 points? And why is this 149 between the 155 and the 150? You know, and point out things like that and conclude that this map is wrong. And so, and there are many cases then where because of this, we're forced to use the exact interpolation map because it appears to be more correct. If you know, however, that there's a lot of error inherent in your data set, it may actually be more appropriate to use the inexact interpolation. You can maybe be able to make a pretty strong case to justify why that's the case. I mean, if you have duplicate samples where you have pretty different results, there's error in your lab methods that you really should be accounting for. I work with state well databases a lot, and very frequently they don't give locations of wells very accurately at all. So if I'm trying to draw a contour map of groundwater elevations using those data points, I mean, should I really be trying to match them all exactly and making the contours take all kinds of crazy bends and turns when I know the locations could be wrong by hundreds of feet? And so this is just a case for professional judgment and knowing your audience and really understanding your data set and like what you're trying to present, you know, and try to decide whether you need to stick with exact interpolation or, you know, inexact interpolation may actually be more appropriate. So geospatial models, like any model, are only as good as the data that you can give them. And if you leave out anything important, then you're not going to get good results from the model. So we have kind of a hypothetical test case here to illustrate. We have a shallow alluvial aquifer here that's adjacent to the Big River. And we've discovered some contamination here. And so a pump-out system, PW1, has been installed. It's been activated, and then now we're going back out and trying to judge whether it's working right or not. And so we've collected groundwater levels at a number of other nearby wells, and then drew a contour map, evaluated a downgradient flow path from MW1. Sure enough, it goes straight to the pumping well. So everything looks good. But if we take a little closer look at this, there are some issues that need to be addressed. So the Big River here is thought to be a gaining stream in the area. That's part of our conceptual site model. However, we have contours that are going perpendicular to the river, which would indicate no flow between the river and the aquifer. So that's a problem. And the reason that happened is because the river elevations are not included in the data set. So the geospatial model doesn't even know the river's there. We also seem to have a lot of closed contours in this contour map, even though only one of these wells, PW1, is actually pumping. And that's an artifact of using inverse distance weighting to generate the contours. So if we try again, do version 2, where we include the river in our elevation data set and we use kriging instead, we get a contour map that's more consistent with our conceptual site model, but it also gives us an exactly different conclusion that the pump-out system's not working and this contaminated groundwater at MW1 is still going straight to the river. So just a reminder to make sure that all necessary data that you need are being included in the analysis so that we don't get inappropriate results. So that wraps up our fundamental section. Just a couple key points to hit here. We have to have spatial correlation in our data set to even do a geospatial analysis in the first place. So that's something to check right away. Our geospatial model can have up to 3 components, the trend, error, and autocorrelation. And, you know, depending what question you're trying to answer would guide you as to which components you actually need to simulate. The variogram is a really key concept. It's used by the advanced methods, but it's really helpful to try to understand the scale of spatial correlation so that we can not space our points too close together. And we need to be careful to make sure that we are being consistent with our conceptual site model. So we're going to break for a question and answers right now, but then after that, Chris Dubs from Ramble is going to go through some detailed step-by-step examples for how to apply these methods.
Thanks, Adam. We do now have time for questions and answers. For those of you on the phone line, we'll give you an opportunity to ask your questions verbally here in just a few minutes. Remember to take the mute off your phone. It is #6. For those of you that would like to submit your questions in the Q&A pod, please go ahead and do that. And we'll have our trainers respond to you directly, and we also may have some of those answered verbally. So if you have a question, please go ahead and submit that. I am going to go ahead and pull up a poll question here for during our break, and if you could respond to that. And the question is, have you used or considered geospatial methods in performing optimization on your projects? So if you go ahead and respond to that. And we have a question from our audience. Says, what software do you usually use to create a variogram?
Yeah, good question. So most any software that can do a geospatial analysis should be able to generate a variogram. What they'll differ on is just kind of how the interface works and like whether or not they have like an automatic fitting algorithm or if you're just left on your own to try to do it by eye and judge the best fit for yourself. I use Surfer pretty frequently for two-dimensional variograms. It has a lot of different models available, and it tends to work pretty well, but it is limited to two-dimensional cases, and it's kind of limited in how you can handle anisotropy. I've also used SGEMS, the Stanford Geostatistical Modeling Software. That one's a lot more complex. It's also one, though, that doesn't have an automatic fitting interface, so you're kind of left to just eyeball it and decide what a good fit is for yourself. I'm not as familiar with it, but I know ArcGIS has some radiogram fitting tools, and I think we have a lot of the examples Chris is going to show in the next section were developed using the R statistical library, and so there's a lot of variogram stuff available there too.
Okay, we have another question. It says, how does an area with potentially multiple contaminant sources affect development of a variogram?
Yeah, it's going to make things a little more complicated for sure. You know, the heart of making the variogram is trying to relate just variability to distance. And so, I mean, if you could try to split off or find some way to, you know, isolate data that you think are related to the different sources, that could be helpful. But if they're commingling, you may just want to consider everything all as like one big picture anyway, and it may not matter quite as much whether you need to actually try to separate them or not.
All right, I want to open it up to our phone lines. If you have a question that you'd like to ask out loud, please go ahead and speak up, and it's #6 to unmute. Looking at our poll question, it looks like about nearly 75% have considered using geospatial methods in performing optimization. So a few haven't yet, and some are unsure, and we strongly encourage you to look at that ITRC guidance document that served as the basis for this training class. And also, as a reminder, we do have archives of this training class. I know it's hard to take in all the information that's provided in 1-2.25-hour session, so if you ever want to go back and listen again, we do have archives available from past offerings. We have another question here. It says, are any of the softwares that you mentioned free?
Yes. And so in the section of the guidance document where we talk about software, we have a table that, you know, talks about different cost levels, you know, and that identifies a number of software packages that are free. Ones that come to mind, there are several that were developed by government agencies. So MAROS is one example of a free software available for geospatial analysis. Also that Stanford Geostatistical Analysis software that I mentioned, that is also a free download. And there are a few others that will appear in the table in the guidance document.
All right, the next question, how is the best way to convince stakeholders to use kriging to interpolate contamination data?
Whether you should use kriging or not, you know, kind of depends on how much data you have. I mean, because you have to have a variogram to really be able to maximize the power of using kriging, you know, you need a fair amount of data to be able to develop a variogram in the first place. So if it's a site where you don't have a lot of data available, you know, it may be a pretty hard sell to try to convince somebody kriging is the best method, because, you know, if you don't really have a variogram developed very well, it may not give you any better results than one of the simple methods. But some of it might just depend on what questions you're trying to answer. I said that one of the things that's very useful about kriging and other advanced methods, or some of the more complex methods as well, is that they give you these estimates of uncertainty for every value that you interpolate. And like having that information available, you know, really goes a long way towards understanding what might be going on at the site, and like, you know, trying to help understand how adequate your sampling network is, and whether you may actually need more data, or, you know, conversely, if you have too much.
All right. Well, thank you for those questions and those answers. We are going to now move on to the second portion of our presentation today, and I'll turn it over to Chris Stubbs with Ramble. Chris.
Okay. Thank you very much. So in this next section, we'll go through some examples of how to use these methods. And here's an overview of the section. There's basically three parts to it. In the first part, we'll just talk a little bit more about how to actually use the data for optimization, to model the data to use it for optimization. We'll go over our geospatial analysis workflow and talk a little bit about what we mean by quantifying uncertainty. And then the next part, we'll go over an example of more complex methods, talk about exploratory data analysis, and show the example using nonparametric regression. And then finally, we'll look at an example of using the advanced methods, showing how to do kriging and also talking about conditional simulation and co-kriging. And then as we're going through that, we'll talk a bit about model evaluation. So here we've got so this kind of view, you can certainly use any of the methods to make nice figures. Even the simple methods can work well for that. But to be a little more quantitative, and in particular to use the predictions for optimization, we recommend that you actually model the data using these more complex and advanced methods. If you do that, you'll tend to get more accurate predictions, and it's also nice because you can quantify the uncertainty in the predictions. And those kind of things make it easier to optimize either your sampling program or other goals. So what I mean by modeling is, like I said, it kind of goes beyond just mapping the data, but we're trying to fit a statistical model to the data, and you can only do that with these more complex and advanced methods. With the simple methods, basically, you know, you just put the data in the method, and you don't really customize the method particularly for your data set. All right, so here's the benefits of the geospatial workflow, and it's useful for both practitioners and reviewers because kind of, you know, reminds you whether you're doing the analysis or reviewing the analysis, the steps that you should go through kind of reminds you to document those steps or help you review documents. And so it's just a generic workflow that we've seen, and we'll sort of look at it in more detail as we go through these examples. So here it is again. There's the five parts to it. The first step is just looking at the conceptual site model, or the CSM, and thinking about the project goals. And as Adam kind of suggested, so for example, if you have a site with a river feature or something like that, you know, that could be a very key and important feature that should be represented with the results of your geospatial analysis. So you want to kind of identify those so that you can make sure that they're incorporated in and represented properly. The second part of the workflow is to do exploratory data analysis. Many of these techniques for exploratory data analysis are not specific to spatial data. They're just a standard techniques to look at the spread and just, you know, distribution of the data and any trends. And then there's some specific spatial tools like the Varigram, which are also should be used. After you've done that, then you move on to choosing a geospatial method. And as we've said, we've kind of categorized these methods into three buckets: the simple, more complex, and advanced buckets, and we'll look at examples from the more complex and advanced methods in this section. After you choose the method, then you want to build the model or fit your data, fit the model to the data, and there's some good techniques for doing this and to checking to see how good the fit is and make sure you can feel confident that your predictions are good. And then finally, you generate the results, which would be the predictions, and also look at the uncertainty in those. All right, so just a little bit about uncertainty when we use these kind of statistical approach. Uncertainty really means, you know, how much variability is there in the data around, you know, our predictions. And it's only the more complex and advanced methods that you can look at these measures of uncertainty. And the standard ones are like standard error and the variance. And those are really the same thing in the sense that the variance is just the square of the standard errors. And we can use those to develop confidence intervals, which everyone's probably seen before, sort of like error bars on our predictions. If you have really wide intervals, then you have more uncertainty versus narrow intervals, and you have a little less uncertainty. For spatial data, another possible way of presenting uncertainty is with exceedance probabilities. So if you have a particular threshold, so for example, a cleanup level that you're interested in, then you could make a map of the probability that that threshold is exceeded. So in areas where there's a high probability, you know, you might want to target, you know, additional investigation or remediation, things like that. All right, here's a quick example of what those measures of uncertainty might look like. So if you have some data here and you fit a model to it, that's just kind of like the best fit line here. We're just looking at it in a kind of a simple one-dimensional example here. But if we put the standard error on that model, we kind of see the relative amounts of uncertainty. And if we make some additional assumptions, we can turn that into an actual confidence interval. So then we're saying that, you know, we're basically 95% confident that the true model should be, you know, somewhere within these bounds here in this shaded area. So that's what I mean by those types of uncertainty measures. All right, so now we're down to the next section here where we're going to talk about an example of a more complex method. And we're going back to this example that you've seen here with the soil sample, surface soil sample results you know, near a river. This is actually in Belgium, where we have metals concentrations that were collected. And here we're just going to look at the zinc. So we've got the bigger circles represent higher concentrations. And just looking at this, you kind of see higher concentrations near the river, in generally speaking. So our conceptual site model might be that it's the flooding of the river that's causing these elevated zinc concentrations over the floodplain. All right, so then thinking about you know, our first step in the workflow, what are the questions that we want to answer? For this example, we'll try and find a 95% upper confidence level for the mean zinc concentration. And we'll think about whether there's some other data that we can use to help inform our predictions of zinc. So that could be called secondary or proxy data. So that's what we'll look at here. So next we'll do exploratory data analysis. And by the way, this example's in the guidance, online guidance document, and it has a bit more detail in there, but we're just going to hit the high points here. So first thing we might do is look at the distribution of the zinc concentration. So the first thing you look at here is just the histogram of the raw zinc concentrations. We see, as we often do for contaminant concentrations, is that the distribution is quite skewed and that there's lots of small values and then just a few higher values. And generally, when we're doing statistical modeling, we like to see you know, less skew. It was more of a kind of a normal bell-shaped distribution. So what we could do here is take the log of all the concentrations and to see if that looks a little bit more symmetrical. So we see when we do that the histogram is a little bit more like a you know, normal distribution. So that's generally going to work better in pretty much any statistical approach. All right, of course, we want to look at the variogram. So here we see definite good evidence of autocorrelation between the zinc data. So we kind of see a little plateau here at around, you know, a little before maybe 700 meters or so, where we kind of reach our sill. So the kind of general scale of correlation is around maybe 700 to 600 meters or so. All right, so when we were looking at the first map of zinc concentrations, we noticed that the concentrations near the river were higher. So in this figure, we're going to look just directly at that relationship by plotting the log sink against the distance from the river, and we see a clear relationship there. And so, one of our goals of this example is to see whether we can use some proxy or additional secondary data to help improve our predictions. So it looks like this sort of distance from the river is a kind of an additional piece of data that we could use. Of course, it's kind of constructed data that we constructed using our GIS software, but that's could be very useful to incorporate in our model. Some other things we look at is soil type. If we just look at this sort of simple representation of three soil types and summarize the concentrations of zinc within each of those soil type regions, we see, in this box plot here that definitely soil type 1 has higher concentrations, and then they kind of go down if you look at soil types 2 and soil type 3. So we can incorporate this type of a variable in our analysis. In this example of a categorical variable of soil type, because it only takes a fixed number of values. It's not a continuous variable like, for example, zinc concentration. All right, so that's all for the exploratory data analysis, and now we're just going to think about what method makes sense. So in this category of more complex methods, these are regression type methods which don't have an explicit spatial correlation model. Of course, the data is spatially correlated, but we're not going to try and model it explicitly. Instead, we're going to use these kind of regression approaches, which can be very flexible in that they can accommodate all different kinds of data, such as the categorical data sets, things like that. It's a little easier in some cases to incorporate features such as faults and rivers and things like that. So these kind of things work best when we have lots of other predictor variables or, secondary data available that we can throw a bunch of different types of data together in a model, as we had in this situation. There are some assumptions that, once we get done with the model, that the residuals or the, what's left over, we take the model predictions and subtract the original data values, that those aren't, we don't have any autocorrelation in those and that they're generally normally distributed. But we do get out prediction standard errors and variances. And here we have a list of some of the typical more complex methods, and there's more description of these in the online guidance. But the parametric regression is probably the regression everybody's most familiar with, just regular regression that you learn about in a preliminary, an introductory statistics class. And then some more modern ones that have a bit more flexibility, such as splines and kernel smoothing. And those can be used in a regression framework, which is usually called nonparametric regression. So just to illustrate what I'm talking about here, so if it were just a standard parametric regression, for example, we would fit a surface, a trend surface to the data just based on functions of the x and y coordinates. And so, for example, here's showing something would be like a quadratic surface. So it's fairly simple. But if we use a nonparametric regression approach based on splines or something like that, then we can model much more complicated surfaces, which are more realistic, such as shown here in the example. So that's why we tend to use these more nonparametric approaches when we have complex data sets. We need to have a more complex surface. All right, so we're going to use the nonparametric regression approach because we've got some good secondary data sources, and we looked at the distance to the river, we looked at the soil type, and then in the online guidance, it also shows the flood frequency as another variable that we can use. And we'll use a thin plate spline as in our nonparametric regression to kind of fit this surface. We'll talk a little bit about the model evaluation techniques, the model evaluation techniques are discussed a bit more in the example here, but of how to make sure you've selected the right secondary variables and just make sure that the model is working. All right, so here's what we get with that approach. Here's the predicted values over here. They look generally good in that they're higher near the river as we expect. We see some, you know, nice detail in there. And the prediction standard errors are fairly similar pattern, which probably makes sense. And then just to make sure that we're meeting the assumptions of this method, we'll look at the variogram of the residual. So we take those predictions and subtract the data points, and that's the residual. And then we want to do a variogram of those to make sure there's no spatial autocorrelation. And as we learned previously, when we have a kind of a flat line for the variogram, that means there's no autocorrelation. So, you know, we've met that assumption, so we're good with this model. And then we'd use that those predictions to do some optimization, depending on what our goals were. So here we might, look at the concentrations with confidence limits and compare it to the remediation target concentration. And then that would allow us to focus in on the areas that need either additional sampling or remediation or whatnot. So that's how we kind of use that more complex approach. All right, so in this next section, we'll look at the same example, but use one of the advanced methods. So we've got the same data, same conceptual site model. We're basically going to do the same thing. But in this case, we'll assume that we don't have any of this secondary data available. And we'll kind of look at some similar questions, but look at the areas that require remediation and maybe where additional samples might be needed. Okay, so for these advanced methods, the big difference is that we're going to explicitly model the spatial correlation. So, we're going to look at the variogram, and then we're actually going to fit a model to that variogram so that we can include that model in our estimation. And I think, as Adam was saying, the creaking tends to work best when we have enough data to use to estimate that variogram or the correlation model. We kind of have to do that step first, and we kind of need a good data set to do it with, basically data that has different spacing so that we can really see what the correlation is at different lags or different sample spacing. So that's kind of important. This method has assumptions as well. One of the big ones is that the data are stationary, maybe after we've removed a trend. That just means that the variogram, the model of spatial correlation would be applicable throughout the area of interest, so that the sort of statistical properties don't change over space. So it makes sense to use the same model for the whole area. And with the more complex methods, we also get a prediction standard error variance, so we can assess the uncertainty. There's basically many different types of creaking and co-creaking that are under this advanced method block, and then some other things that are called conditional simulation, which we'll talk about. One thing about the creaking is we can either do it point by point, or we can use little blocks instead. In other words, have little estimate over little areas, if that's what would work better for us. And we'll see an example of that. All right, so as I said, these advanced methods require estimating a variogram, and that process is sometimes called variography. And we generally just pick from a standard list of models And here's the sort of most common choices. There are a few others, but these are the ones that are most commonly used that you would see in your software. Exponential, Gaussian, linear, Matern, power, and spherical. So one thing you notice is that some of them actually reach a sill, a maximum level, whereas others don't. So we see here for the exponential and Gaussian, they kind of reach a maximum. But for the linear and the power ones, they just keep going higher and higher, so they're unbounded. So that's a sort of significant difference to think about. The other differences sort of tend to relate to how they look near the origin or very small lag distances. So you need to kind of pay attention to the little shapes near the origin. But otherwise, they tend to look fairly similar, and often more than one model could be a reasonable approach. All right, so we're going to have a little quiz just to give you a little practice doing that. So if we look at our data set for the zinc example, and you can see the kind of variogram, the experimental variogram based on the data. And I just want you to pick one or more of these variogram functions or models that would be appropriate. Thinking about behavior near the origin or at the small distances, and then also, what happens as you go out to the greater distances. So as I said, there's definitely, as always, kind of more than one choice that might be appropriate, but there are a few choices that probably wouldn't make sense in this case. So just try and avoid choosing those. So choose as many as make sense for this case. All right, as those are coming in, I'll just say what we'll see in the next part of this is that you can also do some more quantitative evaluations of how good the fit is to the for the variogram, and in some cases that makes sense to do that. That you can kind of get a little more of a definitive answer of which one fits the best. But to start with, generally just eyeballing it definitely makes sense, just to kind of figure out what the range of choices are that might be appropriate. All right, looks like most people have been able to get their answers in. Definitely the most popular choice is the exponential one, and the Gaussian also, Gaussian and spherical also very popular, and a little less popular than Matern, and not too many people thought the linear or the power would be good. So, all right, that's I think good for that. We'll just go on here to look at the answers. So, like I said, I think the linear and the power probably wouldn't make sense because those are kind of unbounded, as you go to longer distances. And our exponential variogram here definitely seems to reach a sill. So those wouldn't be the unbounded ones wouldn't make sense. And I guess I'd say the Gaussian doesn't fit that well near the origin, in that it sort of goes up kind of straight in the experimental one, but then has a little bit of a curve here in that one. So, otherwise, I think these would all work: the exponential, the Matern, and the spherical. I think could work. All right. So, just an example: if we use the exponential. Here's the fit we get. So you see a pretty good fit. And generally, when you're trying to fit these, you really want to pay attention to the shorter distances much more than what happens way out at the longer distances. So the fact that it doesn't fit too well out here is generally not something you'll worry about. You really want to see a nice fit in here, because that's really what's going to determine how well the model works. So, and then one just reminder for people who review these kind of geospatial analyses is that you should see a plot of the varigram and its fit in the report. Ideally, that would be shown so that you can convince yourself that an appropriate model was selected and that that the model was fit to the data appropriately. So that's just a reminder for reviewers. All right, so one thing about fitting varigrams in the case where we've got an obvious trend in the data. So one example where you almost always have a trend is if you're looking at groundwater elevations or water levels. You know, there's always going to be a trend from, you know, higher to lower, which represents where the groundwater flow directions would be. And often when you're doing a varigram, it's better to try and detrend the data first. It sort of makes it a little easier to see your scale of spatial correlation. So here's an example where we've got a trend in groundwater elevations represented by here. Here's the data and the spline fit to it. And if we just look at the varigram cloud, meaning plotting every single pair of data points in a big cloud, and we kind of look at the sort of best fit line through the middle of it, we see that we get an unbounded varigram. And you'll always get this if you've got a trend in your data. So what we recommend is generally to remove that trend first and then do the varigram estimation. Here's just a little list of all the different kriging types, and there's actually, you know, many variations on kriging. And it basically they kind of all have this similar approach in that they rely on the varigram model as their model of spatial correlation, but they tend to have different models for the trend component. If you recall, there's the different components of the model, the trend and the, you know, the autocorrelation and the error. And the big differences in different kriging models is in the trend, whether we assume it's a constant trend, which is either known or unknown, or a more complex function. And we generally recommend that you just use ordinary kriging, which assumes a constant but unknown trend throughout the data. You know, generally, that's what's going to work the best. It's fairly robust. You know, unless there's a trend like, for example, the water level trend, there you might actually try and remove that first before you do the kriging using ordinary kriging. All right, so if we use ordinary kriging with the spherical varigram, here's what we get when we interpolate the zinc concentrations. And then we can also try it again using the exponential varigram. So those are both two choices that seem to fit reasonably well. And you can see it pretty much get the same result, you know, little differences. But, you know, overall, not too much is easy to see just by, you know, appraising these visually. So, you know, we can look at a little bit in more detail in our model evaluation step. So first we want to check out whether the predictions are consistent with the CSM. So in this case, we'd like them to be higher near the river, verify the assumptions of the model. And then we can also use cross-validation to more quantitatively evaluate the model quality. And one nice thing about cross-validation is you can really use it for any method at all, even the simple methods. And the simplest approach to cross-validation is what's called take one out cross-validation, which is kind of just what it sounds like. You basically do the model, you know, you use the model over and over and over again, and each time you take out one of the data points, and then you use the model to predict the value at that data point that you just removed. And so then you loop through all the different data points, and you get a measure of how well the model does at all the measured value, you know, compared to all the measured values. That allows you to look at both the accuracy of the predictions, but then you can actually also check out the accuracy of the standard errors by comparing how well the standard errors at those locations do. Here's kind of an example of what that would look like. I've thrown in both the ordinary Kriging with the exponential variogram and the ordinary Kriging with the spherical variogram, and then just for comparison, I put in a simple method, the inverse distance weighting approach. So we did cross-validation on all three of those models or methods, and what we're plotting here is the results of the cross-validation. So in the x-axis, we have, you know, what the actual data was. So what the data point was, and then we, on the y-axis, we plotted against what the prediction was when we used the model, you know, without that data point in, and just tried to predict it without it. So you kind of see, and if the model was perfect, you know, all the points would just follow this 45-degree line. So they, you know, ideally everything would just be along that line. But we don't see that. We sort of see them all have a sort of fit line through these cross-validation points that's kind of flattened out. And the reason for that is that all the methods smooth out the data. In other words, they kind of smooth off the both the peaks and smooth out the valleys. And you can kind of see that in these results, in that the higher values tend to be underpredicted and the lower values tend to be overpredicted. And that's kind of what we mean by smoothing the data. It's important to remember that you know, all these methods sort of tend to smooth it out. And later on, we'll look at an approach that doesn't result in so much smoothing, which might make sense in some cases. All right, so the other way of looking at the cross-validation is by summarizing them, you know, kind of in a table instead of graphically. And one way of doing that is just by averaging all those errors, meaning the difference between the prediction and the data point. And we can kind of average them different ways. We just take the simple average, which we call the mean error, or we can do a root mean square error, where we take the square root, take the square root of the sum of the squared errors. So, sum of the average of the square errors. So, here's what we would get for our examples here. We see for the mean error, you know, the error for the inverse distance weighting is quite a bit bigger than for the two Kriging methods, telling us that that's not really working quite as well, and it's also negative, so it sort of, you know, tends to underpredict things. Similar result for the root mean square. We see that, you know, the two Kriging approaches seem pretty similar in quality, and but they both do better than the inverse distance weighting. All right, so the other thing we can look at is how well it does with measurement errors or prediction uncertainty. So as we've mentioned, the simple methods, they don't give you a measure of uncertainty. So we can't look at that for the inverse distance weighting. But we can compare our, errors that were predicted by the model versus the actual errors that we get from looking at those residuals. And our, you know, mean standardized error, we want something close to zero. And the root mean square, we want something close to one. So, you know, we kind of see that, you know, they both perform reasonably well. You know, maybe the mean error, the ordinary Kriging's a little smaller, but you know, not a dramatic difference here. Anyway, here's another little reminder for when you're reviewing things. It would be great to see a summary of cross validation where people have described how they consider different models, and to show that the model they selected, you know, performed the best, or at least it was, you know, one of the best ones. Okay, so here's what we get out of it. I think this is using the spherical variogram. You know, one interesting thing with Kriging, the predictions don't look too different than we had from the nonparametric regression, but the standard errors tend to look different. And they all are really small next to the sample points, You know, for example, here, you know, there was a sample point there, so they have small standard errors near the data, and they kind of go up from there. So that's kind of a little difference between what the creaking standard errors look like. So one thing just to point out, I see here, you know, here's a little area where it's both near the river where we expect higher concentrations, but it's also kind of a higher area of relative uncertainty, which may be something to consider for an area for additional sampling. So we combine the predictions with the two times the standard error, we can get a 95% upper confidence limit, and that can be a useful way of summarizing that uncertainty for comparison to remediation goals or risk-based standards and things like that. So that's something we can do with these more complex and advanced methods. All right, so just the alternative, we were looking at point creaking previously. We can also do little blocks. So here we're looking at the predictions over little 100-meter blocks. So it doesn't look too different. It's just kind of smoothed out a little bit because we're kind of averaging it over these little areas. And that can make sense if you're, for example, doing excavation where you sort of have a fixed volume of excavation that you can do at one time. So you're sort of trying to decide, on those kind of decision units whether you should excavate or not. And it might make sense to use block creaking in that situation. All right, so as I said, the predictions from both the regression and the creaking type approaches, definitely smooth things out. They're kind of like, averages or expected values. So an alternative is simulation, where we can kind of get a more realistic version of that variability that might actually exist in nature. So here's kind of an example of a place where we have samples at these circles. And, if we were doing a kriging or a regression, we'd probably have a smooth curve between sample points. But in reality, we probably have some more wiggliness in the data here, and we can kind of imagine that it's wiggly in different ways. So here's all some sort of alternative versions of what's going on in between the sample points. And what we can do is use a computer to sort of simulate all those different possibilities. Here's kind of what it might look like for the zinc example. So we do all these different simulations that are consistent with the data. So at each all the data points, it matches, and it's consistent with our estimated variogram, our model variogram. But then, just kind of fills in, looks at all different possibilities in between data points that's consistent with the data, the variogram. And we do this like, many times, maybe 1,000 times. We get a good sense of what might be going on in between the data, and we can kind of summarize that in different ways. Now, here's an example of what we might do. If what we were interested in estimating is the area that's above a certain cleanup goal. So if we say we want to look at what's the area of our region of interest that's above 1,000 milligrams per kilogram. Well, if we look at each of those 1,000 simulations, we can estimate how much of the area is above 1,000. We see we get a different result for each of the 1,000 simulations. But the most common one, is something here a little less than 300. But then we also see that there's a pretty big range. It might go all the way up to, over 450 or down to close to 150. So it gives us a kind of better appreciation for the uncertainty in that area, which can be very useful for planning things like remediation. All right, so another advanced approach is co-creaking, where you're basically trying to combine data sets optimally. And one case where you might want to do that is when you have two types of sampling. One is like a direct samples where you go out and collect samples and you get, for a smaller number of points, you get a very accurate result. But then maybe by using a geophysical approach or something like that, you can kind of blanket the whole area of interest, but you get a little less accuracy in what you're actually interested in. And co-creating is one way of trying to combine those two sets of data to get kind of a best estimate that has both the kind of coverage over all the area you're interested in, but with the accuracy of the individual samples. This is described in more detail in the online guidance, and it takes a little bit more work, and that you have to do the actually estimate a cross variogram, where you look at the correlation between the two types of data. But that can make sense in some cases. All right, so just a little review of things you should think about when reviewing write-ups of geospatial methods. You should always see a good description of the method that was selected, and you know how it was implemented. Sort of all the parameters that were selected should be described, and some justification for why that method was selected over alternative methods, description of how the assumptions of the method were tested and verified that they were met. It should describe how the parameters for the model and the method were fit, and you know whether they did a goodness of fit evaluation, and whether you evaluated the prediction uncertainty, and maybe ideally quantified it using cross-validation. And then finally, you should always make sure that the results, whatever method was used, are consistent with the conceptual site model and the key features of the site that are really important. All right, so that's it for this section. And in the next part, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Kwasinski. He's going to talk about how to put this all into practice.
Thanks, Chris. That gives us a good overview of the fundamentals of geospatial analysis. So you've seen some examples of data being interpreted. So we've kind of seen some of the methods that can be applied to your data. So as we wrap things up here, I'm just going to go over some of the features of the guidance. And these are some of the things that you can use and the ways that you can apply the guidance to make your projects a little more successful. The guidance has some companion guidance available through ITRC, including groundwater statistics and monitoring compliance guidance, the groundwater statistics for environmental managers training, and the remediation process optimization guidance that Dave spoke about earlier. Just as a reminder, geospatial data or interpretation happens all the time, even when you're looking at raw data on a table and checking it against your site map in your mind, and via your experience, you're performing a type of geospatial analysis. I suspect that most of our audience is becoming familiar with ITRC's guidance, but just as a reminder, some of the features are a little different with every iteration of ITRC guidance. We work to improve it a little bit and make it a little more user-friendly. So now you've got links to things like the glossary at the bottom of every page, and the guidance has a section on it that just helps you work through the guidance and navigate the various pages. One of the features of this particular guidance is the fact sheets. So there's four of them, and they kind of just walk you through the process of performing geospatial analysis, and they're numbered sequentially that kind of walk you through from start to finish. So fact sheet one walks you through the basics and helps you explain how you can use geospatial analysis during the various life cycle stages of your project. Some other things like addressing regulatory barriers. I've noticed over the course of our training that when we have that first poll question, the use continually increases and the reluctance to accept geospatial models decreases. So that's all very encouraging. Fact sheet 2 helps walk you through whether your site conditions and your data sets are applicable to geospatial analysis and can help you answer some specific questions relative to the various life cycle stages. And number three walks you through how the analyses are conducted to build a geospatial model. And one thing that we've kind of touched on throughout this presentation is you need to know your data, and you need to know how it fits in with your conceptual site model. When you run these geospatial models, they're not a replacement for your professional interpretation of site conditions, but they are designed to help supplement that understanding and enhance and support it. And then finally, Fact Sheet 4 walks through what types of software are available. I think that was a question in our intermission question and answer period. So as an example, if you do, for the few people that are still encountering some reluctance to acceptance of these methods, this guidance is a good reference that you can use to either a client or perhaps a regulator to help explain the reasoning you use, you know, why you selected certain methods, why you presented the interpretation that you presented to support your recommendations and conclusions. So keep this in your pocket or as a reference for if you do encounter that type of reluctance in the future. One of the nice features of this guidance is the project manager's toolbox. It links back to the fact sheets, so you can always have access to those and some of the other useful tools in the guidance specifically for project managers. Each of the pages can be bookmarked, of course, so if you're going to use this fairly frequently as a project manager, this would be a good one to save in your favorites or to your bookmarks. Another one that we've discussed a little bit is the review checklist. This is a great way to communicate with a regulator or someone on your team who is tasked with reviewing the output, and it kind of walks you through the selections that were made, and if necessary, it can point those folks to the applicable parts of this guidance that are relative to the questions that you're attempting to answer. When it comes to choosing methods, here's a section in the PM's toolbox that walks you through selecting the methods and also helps you make that decision depending on what data are available to you and what questions you're attempting to answer. Also walks you through common misapplications. You know, as we've mentioned before, these models don't replace your understanding of the project. But I've been noticing that a little more and more over time. A lot of applications are being offered where the software itself just runs the model and provides the output. So this guidance can help you understand how that's happening, but also help you avoid some of the pitfalls that can be associated with that. So I would caution you not just to automatically accept the output, but have an understanding of what's happening in those calculations themselves and avoid some of these missteps that can lead to making wrong decisions on a project, where the whole point of this offering is to help optimize your remediation efforts. It's broken out into several categories of the mistakes that are commonly made, mistakes that can be made with the conceptual site model and when performing exploratory data analysis and the use of the models. So again, know the assumptions that go into the models and evaluate whether those are consistent with the site that you're working on. Another one is evaluating your data set. Evaluate whether the requirements of your conceptual site model are met before you attempt to jump into performing the geospatial analysis, and know which methods are available depending on the data that you have available. This is also a tool if you've got some junior staff that you want to bring up to speed. This is a great way to explain which methods are available depending on which data you have available. Again, so you're training your staff to help make right decisions. And here's an example of how you can help make the right decisions depending on the life cycle stage that you're in. Choosing the correct method depending on what you're trying to accomplish. So here's an example of some of the questions that you might need to answer during the site characterization phase. And the same type of flowchart and decision-making matrices are available for the other life cycle stages. Again, another way that you can use this guidance as a training tool for your staff. We had this question on software selection. There's lots of options available to you depending on your needs and also depending on the level of skill that you have with performing these analyses. If you're fairly confident with your skills, you could probably jump to some of the more advanced ones, but it also helps you tailor your selection of software to your level of skill. So if you are fairly new to this, you may choose some of the models that run the simple analyses that might help you get a better handle on exploring these tools to work on your projects. And within there, within the guidance, there are the tables. And this table here from the guidance shows how you can select the correct software depending on what you're trying to accomplish. And it also gives a rank of each of these software to answer each of these questions. These tables are embedded Excel files, so if you'd like to, you can go ahead and download them and sort and filter them however you need to meet the needs of whatever project you're working on. Also, if you know what kind of output you want, if you already know that, you could use a table like this to select the appropriate software for that. Again, you can choose it by depending on the life cycle stage that you're in or the specific question that you're attempting to answer. And then, again, the rankings. So here's some ways that you can use your geospatial analysis and apply those analyses to your project, you know, different types of topics that you might be facing that need to be addressed, and ways that the geospatial analysis can help you address those issues. Here's an example from the guidance, and it provides a depiction of a contaminant plume decreasing over size, or excuse me, decreasing in size over time. So this could help you answer whether you're using the correct monitoring wells to monitor your plume. You could use something like this, of course, to justify removing wells from a monitoring plan. But with any of these methods and any of these interpretations that you produce, they're generally a snapshot of conditions at a certain time. And it's always best to compare that to some known baseline. But it's also very important to note the assumptions that are used in the modeling. You need to know those. You need to know how the boundary conditions were established, for example, and note whether those assumptions are applicable to the site that you're working on. If we've got any regulators in our audience, they need to also be aware of the assumptions that go along with these geospatial models. If you've got an incorrect assumption, you're going to perhaps make incorrect decisions. So that's something to keep an eye out for. Here's an example from the case study portion of the guidance. In this example, the 95% upper confidence limit was used for each of these sampling domains. They look kind of pixelated in this example, but they still work for most situations. They certainly worked for this particular one. And they helped show lead concentrations for pre-excavation and post-excavation conditions. So this is, you know, one example of a way that you could use your geospatial analyses to optimize a project. So it leads to improved planning, and it also can be used to demonstrate that the goals that you set have been achieved. So just as we wrap things up here, keep in mind that this guidance provides information on the tools that you can use to perform or enhance your interpretation and also create presentations of your interpretations, again, in support of your CSM, but not to replace it. Some other things to keep in mind, again, remember that depending on the methods that you can apply, the visual that you present can look very different. We've seen these earlier. These were all taken from the same data set, but you can see how the methods applied to them can make the interpretation look quite different. And also we focused on mostly using this in situations where we're applying it to contaminant information at a site, and there are a couple ways that can be specifically applied, and including estimating concentrations, evaluating your contaminant plume intensity and extent, so getting a handle on your source area and also your threats to your points of exposure. Also, the sample spacing. You know, a lot of the costs that go into these investigations, a pretty large chunk of them include collecting data and mobilizing to a site to collect that data. So if you can come up with a plan that spaces out your sampling efficiently and reduces even one remob to a site, your efforts will pay off. And again, of course, when you get into active remediation, optimizing your efforts, making sure that you're achieving your goals and being able to support your conclusions. Just some final thoughts on the guidance, and I'll send it back over to Mary. Even though we've kind of focused on environmental data, there are lots of other ways that you can perform geospatial analysis that'll help your projects. Think about combining your high-resolution site characterization with a quick evaluation. These are other tools that can be used to map out and display not only contaminant, but also your hydrogeologic information, and that can provide valuable insights in what you know and understand about your site. Evaluate whether you've got the stability of your plume. You can also use these to back calculate how much of your source material had to be released to create a plume of the size and shape that you see. So there's lots of different ways to apply this, and I'd ask you to consider that as you use this guidance. So with that, thank you all for your time today, and I will send it back over to Mary.
Thanks, Mike, for sharing those ideas on application. We certainly encourage you to access the guidance document, and we hope that it will serve as a tool for you moving forward. We do have time for questions and answers, so if you haven't submitted a question and you have one, please go ahead and do that in the Q&A pod. And also, we'll give our phone lines an opportunity to ask any questions they may have verbally. There are a lot of links to additional resources that you can check out associated with this guidance document to support your using of it. We also ask that you fill out the feedback form Your feedback helps us not only to improve this course, but also future courses ITRC will be developing. Also, that feedback form is an opportunity for you to get a certificate of participation if you need that to support your continuing education credits. Make sure that you fill that form out and you check that box to certify you attended. If you forget to check the box, just go back in, fill that form out again, check the box, and your certificate will be generated for you. So on open back to our phone lines, if you have a question for our trainers, don't forget to hit #6, and if you would ask your question, we'll open it up for you now. I'm going to pull up a couple additional poll questions. If you go ahead and fill those out. Now, based on your participation in today's training, are you ready to use geospatial analysis for optimization at environmental sites? So I know we threw a lot of information at you in a pretty short period of time, but that's really where you can go back and rely on that guidance document. For more information, you can also reach out to our trainers if you have questions, and certainly go back to an archive of a past offering of this training class. So if you'd fill out that poll, we'd very much appreciate it. We have a question, it's more of a comment that came in at the end of our first Q&A. There was a person that asked a question about convincing stakeholders about kriging and interpreting contamination data. And this person then followed on with a comment, and I just wanted to see if any trainers had thoughts. So sometimes it's hard to use a kriging method because in contamination data, we normally have a lot of outliers. So any suggestions from the trainers on how this person could handle their data set?
I think that is a good point that it can sometimes be tricky using kriging, particularly if you just only have data from, you know, the highly contaminated parts, but not really spread out over an area. Definitely one suggestion is to try and krieg the log data or otherwise transform data. That does tend to work a bit better. And if you really have a very high outlier in one particular spot, of course, you know, you probably wouldn't want to give that too much weight when you're doing the varigram estimation part. So, you know, it definitely can be tricky, and that's why you might want to consider some of the other methods as alternatives to kriging in those cases.
Right, we have a question asking about how can someone get more information, you know, beyond listening in on this training course and accessing the ITRC guidance document. They're wondering if there's other courses out there that you may recommend or classes they could be taking at the college and university level that may assist them with applying this type of method.
Yeah, well, I guess just on the topic of using statistics in environmental work, you know, ITRC does have another guidance document on groundwater statistics, which would be more of the, you know, non-spatial statistics companion to this course. There are some references, obviously, in the GRO guidance about other documents. Some of the EPA documents can be quite comprehensive and good ways to learn things. I'm also aware that there are some, you know, free online courses, the sort of the, you know, massive online courses that you can sign up for that cover some of these same topics. I know there are a few on geospatial methods, which you can probably, you know, locate by just Googling them. But yeah, other than that, that's all I can think of. I don't know if anyone else has any ideas.
Adam or Mike, anything to add?
Chris just mentioned it, but those other companion guidance to this one, groundwater statistics and monitoring compliance, and groundwater statistics for environmental managers, those are both good sources to kind of enhance your overall knowledge of the topic.
Right, one last chance for our phone lines. Any questions for the trainers? All right, we are going to go ahead and wrap up today. If we have not addressed your question, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we'll get those questions over to the trainers. We very much appreciate the time of our trainers that they took not only to develop this course, but deliver it multiple times. So a very special thank you to all of them. And also thanks to our participants. If you would like to learn more about this topic, we certainly do encourage you to access that ITRC guidance document. There's a wealth of information and tools in there, as well as many other resources and references. You can always access the archives of past offerings, not only of this class, but other classes that may be interest to you that you could put in your toolbox. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us. Please fill out that feedback form and click that box at the end if you want a certificate of participation.